From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Arianna Huffington is a nationally syndicated columnist, the founder of the Huffington Post Online, the co-host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, and the head of the Detroit Project, an environmental public interest group. In 2003, Ms. Huffington was a candidate, along with Arnold Schwarzenegger and a host of others, to replace California Governor Gray Davis. She joins me now to talk about her 11th book on becoming fearless in love, work, and life from Little Brown and Company. And I'm very pleased to welcome her back to my show. Hi.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You open your book by saying that you were surprised that your teenage daughters have many of the same fears that you had growing up, such as a concern with beauty and popularity. Is being afraid, you think, something that's just a part of human nature?
Yes, it is. It's universal. But what is surprising is that when we are really little, 7, 8 years old, I remember my daughters being fearless, bold, ready to tackle anything. And then suddenly, as consciousness emerges, fears emerge. And so the book was really a gift to them, first of all, you know, how to lead fearless lives. And I don't mean by that lives without fear, because there is no such thing, but lives where we don't let our fears stop us.
There are even some fears that are hardwired. I know somebody who just cannot look at a film of snakes because it's actually built into her, has been ever since she was a baby, and I think that might even be something a lot of humans have. But are there fears you think that are unique to each generation? Are there fears that are unique to our generation?
I don't think there are fears necessarily unique to our generation, except for perhaps in the case of women, the fear of how we look, especially how thin we look, which seems to be a cultural stereotype that is particularly present in our culture, you know, that you have to be size 2 to be really attractive, which I say in the book how it's very different from the whole European ideal. You know, I'm Greek and I grew up in Europe, and there's the French term jolie laide, who a woman who is not necessarily conventionally beautiful, but who is magnetic, alluring, interesting, and all the other ways in which somebody can be attractive.
In fact, I just read a poll in which people said that they'd prefer to lose 10 pounds to getting advanced at their job and some of the other things that you would assume they would have wanted.
I know, and yet it's something which is completely culturally imposed. Because throughout different cultures, as you said, there are different ideals of beauty. And now,
sometimes it's gaining 10 pounds.
Exactly. Especially if you are from the Middle East. I think it's probably gaining 10 pounds. But I know one of my younger daughters went through an eating disorder. So I became very acutely aware of how intense and strong these messages are and how we need to build our own fearlessness muscle, as I call it, to be able to counter them.
Do you think that fear that men tend to remain fearless, unless they're Democrats, of course, whereas women develop these fears because of society's pressures?
I think that most fears are universal, both for men and women, but there are three kinds of fears which I think are more prevalent, and research shows are more prevalent among women. One is the fear we mentioned of how we look. The other is the fear of speaking out. Women seem to be more afraid to speak out, to assert themselves, to have their voices heard. And there are more cultural stereotypes about that. A woman who is called ambitious is somehow looked at as being a self-promoter or
pushy,
exactly, aggressive. never words that would be applied to a man. Marlo Thomas said once that for a man to be called ruthless, you have to be Joe McCarthy. For a woman to be called ruthless, you have to put somebody on hold.
Well, there are certain fears that change from time to time. Obviously, during the Cold War, it was atomic bombs and things of that sort. Now we have a lot more fears: subway attacks, terrorism, anthrax. We're sure that New Yorkers are sure that we'll face another terror attack. President Bush devised a color system to alert Americans to the times when we should be on highest, when we should be fearing things, the times that we should be most afraid of attacks. So fear has kind of built up since 9/11.
Of course, these are all fears for our safety, and there is obviously a legitimate part to these fears, but if you look at 9/11, it was a fear-filled day, but our response was a response of fearlessness, and that's really what I'm talking about, that this is getting that kind of response that often is evoked by times of crisis, when suddenly everything else is put in perspective, and we're not afraid if we look 5 pounds heavier in our jeans, because the World Trade Center has just exploded, so who cares if we look 5 pounds heavier? So putting our fears in perspective, which comes in times of crisis, either collective political crisis or personal crisis, is something which we need to bring into our lives even without a crisis.
My guest is Arianna Huffington. Her latest book is On Becoming Fearless, Love, Work, and Life. It's published by Little Brown. So you say that most women are afraid to speak out. How much of that is real fear and how much is the result of the things I have to contend with? Sexism from male colleagues, as you suggested earlier, and even the kind of attention that the media might put upon them that they might not put on men.
Absolutely. I think a lot of those fears are culturally imposed. But what I'm arguing in the book is that we can actually be bigger than the cultural stereotypes and not internalize them. And if we don't internalize them, they don't have the same power over us. And for me, at least, you know, I started speaking when I went to Cambridge and got involved in the debating society there. And at first, I was terrified. I had to write down every word. I was terrible at it. On top of it, I had a heavy accent, which you may have noticed I have not lost. And so I had to deal with ridicule as well as learning how to speak. So I found that embracing failure is part of becoming fearless, you know, that it's not going to work necessarily right away.
Well, actually, that accent probably didn't hurt you when you were debating Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It didn't hurt him either.
Are exceptions like Hillary Clinton, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Kay Bailey Hutchinson exceptions to the rule?
Well, they're exceptions in that they got so far because obviously they were willing to speak out and willing to take risks. But what is very interesting is that often after women reach a certain point, whether in politics or in corporate America, then they become fearful of losing what they got. And that's one of the worst fears. Fear of somehow being thrown back to where you were when you started. And as a result, we see a lot of women in politics becoming afraid to really take strong stands, and you begin to hear the caution with everything they say.
You say that you cried when Hillary Clinton talked about her opinions about the war in Iraq, but she really elicits a lot of emotions, and you wonder whether it's because of her political views, because she's Bill Clinton's wife, or because she's an outspoken woman.
Well, for me, she's not outspoken enough, and the reason.
But she was in the past, perhaps. People even used to joke that she was manipulating Bill Clinton, something you've had to contend with when your ex-husband
yes,
ran for
that's
office.
Another stereotype, you know, the strong woman behind the man that our culture has imposed on us. But I feel that since the war is such a defining issue for a political leader not to be taking a strong stance on the war because of fears of losing or of fears of being perceived as wanting to quote-unquote cut and run, you know, basically buying the framing of the opposition, is fear-based. You know, there's no other reason not to.
But is this something that is something a women experience? I mean, the leadership of the Democratic Party, male and female, has come under some criticism for appearing to be afraid to say the wrong thing or for being afraid to take a stance on the war in Iraq. Why do you think so many Democrats have been afraid to speak out, male and female?
I really believe that the fear of losing and the mistaken belief that if you take a strong stand on Iraq, you are going to court the other side calling you a peacenik or calling you not being strong enough for national defense, and buying into that framing is what led, say, Democratic leaders to vote for the war authorization resolution back in 2003, when many of them already knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. No matter what they may be saying now, there were enough people in the Senate and in Congress who knew that.
Well, despite the president's low approval ratings and general discontent with the situation in Iraq, few pundits are predicting that the Democrats will win back Congress in the upcoming elections. Is it because they haven't been speaking out, or because when they do speak out, they are pounced upon?
No, I think it's because they have not articulated an unambiguous position on the war. The war is the defining issue. It's taken a long time for Democrats to even acknowledge that, because they're much more comfortable talking about domestic issues. And the truth is that in a post-9/11 reality, you're not going to become a majority party if you don't have a clear and equivocal position on security.
So the Democrats are talking about Walmart and about the minimum wage, important
all
things.
All very important issues. But you first have to basically convince the American people you're going to keep them safe. It's kind of interesting. I have a blog on the Huffington Post today about the fact that security moms are abandoning George Bush. You know, security moms were the women who were particularly concerned about their safety and security and the safety of their children, who trusted him to keep them safe, are now abandoning him, including Southern women. And
but they're going to vote for the Republican candidate for Congress nonetheless. That's what
the polls are indicating. But that can shift if Democrats can convince the security moms that they're actually going to keep them safer, which they could do if they took a strong stance on Iraq and stopped saying, as Hillary Clinton said on the floor of the Senate, that we need a different Secretary of Defense to complete the mission, as though there is a mission to be completed.
President Bush didn't appoint a woman to replace Sandra Day O'Connor for the Supreme Court, but he has relied on the advice of women like Condoleezza Rice and Karen Hughes. Is that a sign of change in the attitudes in the highest levels of government?
You know, obviously, I love it every time there is a woman in a position of authority and power. But for me, ultimately, it depends on what advice are you giving. And are you willing to speak your mind? And again and again, we see women who reach top positions and then they become afraid of losing those positions. And that's when, you know, we said earlier about putting fears in perspective and how important that is. I write in the book about the Romans who used to carve MM, memento mori, remember death, on statues and trees, not as a sign of morbidity, but as a sign of perspective. The ability to actually put your own problems in some context larger than our lives.
There are some people who would argue that women who really reach the highest levels of power, like Margaret Thatcher and Indira Gandhi, are really acting like men. You can't tell much of a difference between what they would do and what men do, and so voters feel more comfortable with them.
Well, there's no reason why voters shouldn't feel comfortable with women. What we are finding out is that the fact that they are women doesn't mean that they are going to make different kinds of decisions based on their sex or their how they were brought up, that other factors come into play.
My guest is Arianna Huffington. Her latest book, her 11th, is On Becoming Fearless: Love, Work, and Life. It's published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after this. ¶¶ We're back with Arianna Huffington. Her latest book on becoming fearless, love, work, and life is published by Little Brown. And the first time I met you was 1988. You had written a book in which you'd taken Pablo Picasso to task for his sexist behavior. Were you already fearless at that time, do you think?
No, I wasn't. But with every book I published and with every criticism I weathered and survived, I became more fearless. That's why I see it as a journey, that we are all born with fears, and every time we take a risk and act despite our fears, we become a little more fearless, and we become more able to tackle the next challenge.
But with that book, you were kind of throwing down the gauntlet. You were calling into question most of the things that people, the favorable things that Picasso is critics say about Pablo Picasso. So you knew that you were going to rub people the wrong way.
Well, what I was saying, and you may remember that I first met you when you interviewed me for that book.
So we were both children at the time.
We were both children, exactly. And I was totally acknowledging Picasso's genius as an artist, but I was questioning his private responses, especially to the women in his life. And what is ironic is that a lot of what I said then, that was 1988, has become very much the conventional wisdom now.
Although people were jumping on you at the
Absolutely. Time. Absolutely. That was a controversial book, and the art world didn't like at all the fact that I called the book Creator and Destroyer and pointed out his destructive side. In fact, what was so interesting is that Picasso, you know, had said that he liked to take goddesses and turn them into doormats. And I bring that into this book on fearlessness because a lot of women stay with men who treat them as doormats. And it's really kind of interesting to see what is it, what is the fear that keeps them with those men.
Well, I've also noticed that some women are uncomfortable if men don't want to treat them like doormats. I mean, there's a more complicated dynamic there.
Well, I think if you don't value
I'm not saying
yourself,
all women. Please do not write me and say Leonard thinks all women want to be doormats. But we've seen that dynamic, just like we've seen the other dynamic of women feeling that they don't want to put up with a man who doesn't respect them.
Well, it has to do ultimately with whether we respect ourselves and whether we are willing ultimately to face the fear of being alone if necessary rather than being in a dysfunctional relationship. And these are fears, again, that women tend to have more than men because we long for a relationship like we crave water and food.
There are people who argue that we should return to all-girls schools as a way of countering this.
Well, my daughters, who are 15 and 17, go to all-girls schools. And I picked all-girls schools for them because it has actually been easier for them to allow themselves to speak out. You know, there's new studies that I quote in the book that even women in Ivy League colleges, clearly smart women, hold back because they don't want the boys in the class to think that they are so smart that they don't want to date them. So if you're growing up and you're in middle school and high school, it's great to be able to speak out and not worry if the boy next door is going to think you're too smart. And I've seen, you know, both my daughters, especially my younger one, who are shyer, really be able to speak out and love the debate without that kind of fear.
What challenges did you face when you ran in 2003 for governor of California?
Actually, I write about those challenges because I was amazed by how the stereotypes about women speaking out held. I remember the debate with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Cruz Bustamante, who was the lieutenant governor at the time, in which Schwarzenegger told me to drink more decaf, meaning, you know, I should calm down. Yes, and not be so passionate about what I was saying, which you cannot imagine a politician saying that to a man, right? You cannot imagine that. It's a term that can only be addressed to a woman. And then Cruz Bustamante, every time I would speak, would say, yes, Arianna, in this kind of condescending tone that men reserve for uppity women, like take two Midol and you'll feel better in the morning.
Well, but could you have even gotten to the point where you could mount a reasonable challenge if you hadn't once been married to a man who ran for Senate? That made you famous in political circles, didn't it?
Well, definitely the fact that I had been married to Michael and the fact that I had been involved in his campaign taught me a lot about politics, including about what not to do in politics, because I saw how easy it is for campaigns to be taken over by pollsters and campaign consultants and how harder it is to stand up for what you believe. Absolutely, I learned a lot from that. At the same time, the thing that I took away from the campaign more than anything was to see all these young women who, after a debate, would come up to me and thank me for speaking out. And honestly, I was really surprised at first because I thought, why are you thanking me for speaking out? And it made me realize how young women still look for role models. And I must say, I honestly was surprised because I thought we've won so many battles. The feminist movement won so many battles for women. Why do young women still need to be validated?
Did you think they voted for Dianne Feinstein in that election? She beat your ex-husband, Michael Huffington.
Yes, narrowly, surprisingly enough, given that Michael was a newcomer.
Although he spent a heck of a lot of money on that campaign.
Exactly. At the time, it seemed like a lot of money. Now they're all spending that kind of money. But at the time, it was a lot of money.
And you eventually pulled out of the race for governor. Why?
I did because...
You didn't fear that you'd lose.
No, I knew I would lose by then. I pulled out because there was a slim chance to stop Schwarzenegger from becoming governor by defeating the recall. And so I spent the last 10 days campaigning to defeat the recall as a way to stop Schwarzenegger. We failed. And Schwarzenegger has been really bad for California and went out and campaigned for George Bush in Ohio, which may have helped George Bush win Ohio. So it would have been better if he had been stopped, even though Gray Davis was a very ineffective governor. But it didn't happen.
Well, how did you come to this point? I know I've asked you before why you left the Republican Party in 1996 and became a Democrat. I assume there was a certain amount of trepidation on your part when you made a step like that.
There was a lot of trepidation. I write in the book about how I had to face the fear that I would lose friends, which I did. And I describe a dinner party in Washington at the house of Boyd and Gray, who was a counsel for the first President Bush. And I was surrounded by Bill Frist and Tony Snow and Mr. and Mrs. Rush Limbaugh. And I was definitely in enemy territory by then, with Mrs. Limbaugh wondering why I was there.
But she's no longer married to him either.
And I'm no longer being invited to these dinner parties.
But are those the kinds of friends you want? I'm sure you still have friends from the old days.
Absolutely.
Friends who probably are strong supporters of the president, even though you've been critical, because there are other factors.
Absolutely. But at the time, the fear that you're going to lose your friends is real. You know, in retrospect, as you say, you keep the friends who really are your friends. But at the time, it's one decision you have to make.
My guest is Arianna Huffington. Her latest book, On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life, is published by Little Brown. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, one person who doesn't seem to be afraid of losing his friends is Senator Joe Lieberman. he has been rejected by some of his friends in the party. Now, can he be described as being fearless, a role model for people who need to think about how to be more fearless?
Oh, I don't really think so, because if you look at Joe Lieberman's positions, if you take the war, for example, he's taken a very conventional going along with the president on the war position.
Because he says he believes in it.
Yes, well, I cannot claim whether he believes in it or not. But there's no question that his decision to run as an independent, I would say, is very fear-based, his fear of being out of office. There are many politicians for whom survival is tantamount to office holding. It's as though their own identity is so wrapped up in being in office that they cannot imagine a life without it. And I think that's the case with Joe Lieberman.
Well, what about someone like Ralph Nader, who ran for president, even though he was criticized for taking away votes from the Democrats? He said he was standing by his principles. Is he a role model?
You know, I don't think that people who make decisions which I disagree with, whether they're based on fear or fearlessness, I think we have to judge the decision. Is it a decision that was in the public interest, or is it a decision that was based on narcissism or some other consideration that didn't have to do with the public interest? I think that's the way to judge them.
Getting back to some of the things you write about in your book, you say to live in fear is the worst form of insult to our true selves. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that I happen to believe in that we are spiritual beings as well as material beings, that life does not end with death, that there is another dimension to life. And when you accept that, it brings a sense of trust about life, that whatever happens, good and bad, and in every life there is both, there is a purpose to it. It may be a purpose we don't clearly understand, but there is a purpose, that life is not arbitrary.
But it's my sense in thinking about fear and fearlessness that people are different in this just as they're different in everything else. I've spoken to a number of novelists and asked them, why did you suddenly take on this incredibly ambitious project? And they said, well, you know, I didn't want to do the same thing. I keep on challenging myself. I want to go further and further. And I can understand that. I think your life, to some degree, has been a series of thinking about whether you want to challenge yourself and go further or not. But there are a lot of other people who are perfectly happy and should not be criticized for taking a different kind of a road, preferring to be domestic or to have a safe job that provides them with the things they want, whatever
may be. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I'm talking about the people who want to do different things, who want to face challenges, who want to, say, leave a dysfunctional relationship or an unfulfilling job, and they don't do it because they're afraid. These are the people I'm addressing myself to. And what I'm really saying is take the risk, act on what you want, even if you're afraid, and the rewards are enormous.
What do you mean when you write that women should compare themselves to a victim of Hurricane Katrina rather than Angelina Jolie?
Well, what I'm saying is that I think we should not be ideally comparing ourselves to anybody, but accept our uniqueness in every aspect of our lives. But if comparisons are so much part of our DNA that we can't avoid it, why are we comparing ourselves to impossible models like Angelina Jolie, say, rather than comparing ourselves and counting our blessings as a result to a woman who lost her legs in Iraq or a victim of Hurricane Katrina or any of the millions of people whose lives are so full of suffering? And as a result, we would feel more grateful. And gratitude, I think, is an incredible emotion, and it helps us become fearless if we're grateful for what we have.
You quote Naomi Wolf, who writes that a side effect of the women's movement is that society's emphasis has shifted from expecting women to maintain the perfect home to expecting women to maintain the perfect face and body. Is fear about the body the most prevalent fear? You suggested that it was with your daughters, but do you think that happens when women get older as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Is that why we're seeing so many women with that startled look in their eyes, and some men now more and more, because they've had their eyes fixed, even though it makes them look much
and
too
like
young
an
and
alien.
Too old all at the same time?
There are 10 million women who went under the knife last year alone, and to me that's a staggering number. It's a sign of tremendous fear to me to not be able to accept yourself the way you are and accept aging. You know, I grew up in Greece, and in Greece we still kind of revere old age. You know, in Greece, Geronta, which means old man, is a term of incredible respect. You call the abbot of a monastery Geronta. So that's something that we need to bring back here, that acceptance and reverence for age and wisdom.
And do you have things that you're still afraid of?
Yes. I'm afraid of parenting more than anything. I'm afraid of not being a good enough mother.
At this point, your kids are at the age where you really have little control anyway.
Oh, no. You may have little control, but you have a tremendous responsibility. And I deal with these fears, first of all, by observing them and by listening to these voices in my head that keep trying to make me more afraid, and by trying to put everything in some kind of context, as we said, in perspective, so that the fears become smaller than the larger context of our lives.
In 2006, Arianna Huffington was named by Time magazine as one of the most influential people in the world. Let's see if she can influence people to become more fearless, because her new book is called On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life. It's published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.